From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Atlanta's professional women's basketball team, the Atlanta Dream, is preparing for the upcoming season. They had a successful run last year and made it to the WNBA Finals.
Atlanta with a chance to win it. Down by one. Here's Montgomery. 5 seconds. Four. Angel for the win! Good!
Head coach Nikki Collin has been leading the team since fall of 2017, and she's with us to talk about the challenge of leading a professional sports team with the ball in the women's court. Welcome, Nikki.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
To make it big in basketball, people do tend to start quite young, but you had your sights on playing tennis, I understand, when you were younger.
Yeah, absolutely. I started playing tennis in about second grade and just, I don't know, somehow identified with that whole Chris Evert, Martina Navratilova competition and just wanted to be the next Chris Evert and happened to live in a neighborhood that bordered a country club so could get on my bike and ride my bike over to the courts. And so, yeah, I mean, by that dream kind of fell apart in the fourth grade when we moved to Wisconsin and there was like one small, tennis court in the whole town. So that's kind of when basketball started to take off for me.
So how did you start with basketball? Was it the pickup games in the park or was it at school?
Yeah, no, it was actually neither. I had played maybe YWCA, but I wasn't very good in about second, third grade, just as something that you did with other kids. But when we moved to Wisconsin, you know, we had a big cement driveway with a basketball hoop in our driveway. And so it just kind of was one of those things. You're the new kid in a small town and, you know, got a ball. And my dad, you know, started making me work out there. And it was kind of right there. So I played. I can still point to, you know, everybody has you talk about those aha moments, you know, and I was watching actually my fifth grade daughter in the driveway dribble between her legs the other day. And it took me back to that moment because I realized that, you know, fifth grade, I played in a girls boys like rec league in a game where it was two undefeated teams. And I wasn't one of the best players, but I'd gotten to the point where I was solid, but I hit the game-winning shot. And I can actually point to that moment and say, I think that's when I fell in love with basketball, and it became kind of a part of my DNA from then on.
So many different pieces there. First, that kind of eternal, you know, young person playing basketball, father coaching. Was your dad your first coach?
He actually was an assistant coach on that team. So yeah, absolutely. But he was always kind of, whether you realize it or not, you know, now today all these players have the personal trainers and agility trainers and basketball trainers. That was dad when I was growing up. You know, he was kind of all those things.
So after that aha moment, when did you think I really do have a future in basketball?
You know, I think I came out of the womb pretty competitive. So no matter what I did, I wanted to be the best. I always struggled with losing. It didn't matter what it was. And so I think it was then that, you know, I just got a taste of success with it. And so that kind of created this, I think, desire in me. And it, you know, it started as a, okay, this is what, I didn't necessarily think about it from a scholarship perspective or paying for school. I just knew I wanted to be a really good basketball player. So it kind of started with that. It started with the driveway, but, you know, started going after school each day with my dad to the gym and getting shots up and thinking about where that would lead me. And I never really thought past college. I mean, the pro leagues didn't exist when I was in middle school. So, you know, it was really about, you know, can I get a college scholarship to Stanford? But I didn't even know what that meant then. It was just about playing at the highest level. It was about watching those players on TV at that time when you were just starting to see women's basketball on TV at a high level and think, someday that might be me.
Let's go back to that boy-girl rec league. I saw a poll that the number one career field that little boys dream of when they're growing up is professional sports. For girls, sports don't even make the list, although I will say doctor was number one choice, which I think some progress has been made. But has the door to professional sports for female athletes been closed for so long that they don't even consider it?
Well, I think, you know, when I was that age, the only thing I thought I knew about my life was that I was going to be famous. I didn't know how. I think I genuinely thought somehow, some way I'm going to be famous. I remember moving in the fourth grade and my class doing a party for me and, you know, them writing this little play about my life. And, you know, they had predicted that I would be the first female president.
Whoa.
And so there's no doubt that even at that age that I kind of had that sense of somehow I'm going to make it big. I don't quite know how, but absolutely. I think that was part of the Chris Evert attraction. Like, I was seeing her on TV. I could see it. I couldn't exactly touch it. But I saw that it was real. And so I think what we've got now is with professional sports and women being in professional sports, there's now a path. Young girls can see it, can't even touch it now, getting to the games and can see that it's a possibility.
You studied mechanical engineering in college. Did I have that right?
That's correct.
I'm not thinking of a lot of like really super famous celebrity mechanical engineers.
Yeah, I don't think, you know, ironically, when I was in high school and you start thinking about, you know, careers and you start having to write papers on it, I remember diving into would I want to be a lawyer? Because I certainly always felt like I could win an argument, ask anyone in my family. but then I really, truthfully, the job that I thought was the perfect job for me, and it was because I grew up and I played four sports in high school, and I just was so attracted to the field of sports, regardless of wanting to be a great basketball player, was I looked at Bob Costas and said, I want his job.
Huh. And if listeners don't know, Bob Costas was a longtime NBC sportscaster.
And I don't think I knew what his job was other than, you know, you watch the Olympics and he's right there and he's the one in the studio and you watch the World Series and it's Bob Costas sitting in that seat. And I thought about him being in all those major sporting events and, you know, being in that world in a career driven way. And I thought, well, that's what I really want. But I think when I thought about, well, what do I do when I go to college and what kind of degree do I get? I never thought truthfully about broadcast journalism because I think I thought of it as, you know, his job is the pinnacle. It's like saying I'm a basketball player, so I'm going to be LeBron James, right? Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. how many
start
people
at the
are
top.
That? You know, and I pictured myself on the, you know, 5:30 news in, you know, northern North Dakota and said, okay, maybe not broadcast journalism. So, you know, I loved math, had always enjoyed math, liked science, especially chemistry. And, you know, I decided to play basketball at Purdue. And quite frankly, I chose Purdue because of the basketball, not because of the academics, but kind of that direct connect. Like, if I'm going to go into engineering, I need to do it now because it's such a hard field that if you start in something else, things don't transfer in. The path is so defined in terms of what you have to take to graduate in a timely manner. So, you know, it seemed logical because of my interests and, you know, what I loved about engineering, not ever having been an engineer and still can say I've never been an engineer, is that it's a problem-solving degree. It teaches you how to think, how to make assumptions and grow from those assumptions. And, you know, I always say that what I love about it as much as anything was it was always a partial credit major. So if you were thinking along a certain lines and a professor could tell that you knew what you were doing in terms of your thought process, sometimes the answer, correct or incorrect, it was more about how you got there than the actual answer as opposed to a multiple choice or a true false kind of situation.
So you're not only ambitious, but pretty strategic.
Absolutely. Like, right, I always say that, you know, when I was in college, I spent more time figuring out what the lowest possible grade I could get on a test to get an A than actually studying because I was always driven to get A's. Ultimately, I finished first in my class in engineering, but it was always strategic. You know, it was I defined how long I studied based on how long I thought I needed to work towards a certain grade.
So you were part of that. This is Title IX, happened in 1972. Women's athletics, it was passed. It mandated equal treatment of the sexes in sports. How did that change the game for women's professional sports?
I think it's just opportunity. It gave opportunity. And I think the confusing part sometimes for people about Title IX is what it really means. And it doesn't mean that it's not always apples to apples. It's not always because this person gets this amount of money that this person should get this amount of money as well. But it gave opportunity. You know, when I talked to my mom, who I think some of my athleticism I got from my mom, but she grew up in a small town in Michigan and cheerleading and band were, you know, her only options. And so, you know, it's hard to say because it's not like I think my mom throws a ball like John Smoltz or anything. But She just didn't have any of those opportunities. And it kind of makes me sad to think about, because I will say, even growing up in an environment where I typically played boys sports until I was in high school or played with boys, I played Little League baseball all the way through the eighth grade, was the only girl in the league. No one ever told me I couldn't do something or I wasn't allowed to do it. So, you know, I definitely, I think, am a Title IX baby in terms of not really understanding what it was like before that opportunity existed.
Were there other girls playing at that time, or was it just you?
I was the only girl in Little League baseball. Mm-hmm. You know, my town had slow pitch softball, and I did not consider that an option.
I'm speaking with the Atlanta Dream head coach, Nikki Collin. It's her second season with the team. We're reeling back and learning a little bit about her life, a really directed life from the sounds of it. And before you came to the WNBA, you spent 9 seasons. This was coaching on the collegiate level. So learning the ropes, I guess. Did you ever think that coaching would be your career goal?
Certainly not when I was in college. I was very, you know, I was naturally athletic, had good hand-eye coordination, but I think the reason I was good because of my work ethic. And, you know, I can point back to when I was a collegiate player and having teammates that were naturally 6'2", 6'3", ran like deer, you know, just, and I remember thinking, if they worked half as hard as I work, they're, you know, they could write their path in basketball. But, you know, I had something in my gut, something in my belly. But I really thought coaching would be a tough path for me because, you know, I wasn't sure I could coach people that didn't want it as bad as I want it, who didn't, you know, didn't want to be good at the level that I thought they were capable of. And so I just wasn't sure I could understand that. But then when after I played professionally for a year and it was real world time, you know, and I had to make a decision about what to do with my life. And I actually took a job in engineering, but hadn't started it yet when I got the opportunity to take a coaching job. And the more I thought about it, the more I just realized, like, basketball wasn't out of my system at that time, you know, that I had to pursue it. I had to see if it was something that I was capable of being good at, you know, and over time, here I am.
What did you want in a coach as a player?
Accountability, someone that could truly communicate with me. I'm very much a living in the gray area person. I struggle probably the most to coach players who are black and white. I don't think the world revolves that way. I don't think sports revolve that way. But some people need more direction. So, you know, guidance, trust, loyalty, you know, someone that believed in me. You know, I made a change. I went to Purdue, transferred to Marquette, had great success as a team at Purdue, a Final Four, an Elite Eight, had great teammates, but just wanted to be more impactful on the floor, wanted those minutes, wanted someone to believe I was the person to lead our team, especially from the point guard position. And so, you know, the move was about that opportunity to show that I was capable of showcasing a lot more than I was ever able to do.
You went and played in Greece in the professional league there. Why Greece?
Well, you know, when I got out of college, I tried out for the Detroit Shock, which moved then to Tulsa, which is now Dallas, and really wanted to play in the WNBA. You know, it had started. I thought it was a real possibility for me. Was cut in kind of the last round of cuts in Detroit and thought, I need to go give this professional thing a shot. You know, I'd had a number of teammates and friends that were playing overseas, and you know, their reasons were different than mine. I wanted to go overseas because I wanted another shot at playing in the United States. They went overseas to see the world, you know, and to do it playing basketball and have someone pay them, you know. And so for me, it was about talking to my agent about getting me in the best possible league that I could play in with the best possible competition. And while there certainly were other leagues that were better, you know, beggars can't be choosers kind of thing. And so, you know, it was a good league. It wasn't a great team. But, you know, ironically, that year there were two professional leagues, the ABL and the WNBA. The ABL folded while I was over in Greece. And I kind of knew at that point that there weren't going to be a lot of spots for a 5'5 point guard in a league that had 8 teams to start, you know, and you had a league, the ABL, that was a more traditional league because it was a winner league. It paid higher salaries. You had a lot of really, really talented players that were going to be moving into the WNBA at that point.
So then coming back to that completely new universe of what was going on in women's professional basketball in the U.S., Was it a come down for you to think of coaching rather than being a player?
In some ways, ironically, it still is. Mm-hmm. You know, I always say that, you know, I watch Vince Carter, who's only 2 years younger than me, you know, running up and down the court for the Hawks now. And I sometimes think, wow, if I could still be doing that. Like, there's just some joy, something about the competitiveness of playing and the joy of playing that's different when you're in coaching. At the same time, I think I've learned to truly embrace it. I know it's something that I'm confident about. I know it's something that... I think I knew from early on in coaching that I was a good communicator, that I found ways to communicate with different types of players. And so, you know, I don't know that it's a come down as much as it's just a different avenue to be a part of a sport that you just love and feel like you, like my whole life is defined by that moment I hit that game-winning shot, because where basketball has taken me from around the world in coaching and playing, you know, I met my husband through coaching. I have three kids. You know, basketball has kind of been that thing that has driven the path of my entire life.
But as a coach, when you're wearing a lot of hats, you have to be, you know, part mentor, part team mom, I'm guessing, therapist, a leader. What are these off-the-court roles like?
Well, I think it's a little less in the pros than it is in college. I think a huge part of coaching in college is that mentor relationship. I think when you're in the pros, you suddenly now have... You're working with adults, you know, players that are getting paychecks, that are going home and doing their own thing and have interests outside. They're not just going to class in college. But I will tell you, I think I became a better coach when I had kids because I started to understand coaching from a different perspective and communication from a different perspective and happiness and, you know, a lot of little things that way and communicating with parents of recruits. And so, you know, it's important to me. And I think most of the players know that I'm very relationship-based. I'm not outcome-based. While I won't keep a job very long if the outcome isn't consistently good, and I understand that I think part of why we were able to turn it as quickly as we were here in Atlanta is that, you know, we built a good culture. And, you know, our players like playing together. They knew I had their back, that I genuinely care about them off the court. And quite frankly, I'm just one of those people that's not afraid to hug them. I tell them I love them on a daily basis. I just, you know, I kind of don't let those things slip through the gaps.
I'm speaking with the Atlanta Dream head coach, Nikki Collin. This is her second season with the team, and we're going to hear more about her transition to the WNBA and her leadership role with the Atlanta Dream team. Stay with us. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott, along with Nikki Collin. She's the Atlanta Dream head coach. And we've been talking a little bit about how she came through her own time as a player to become first assistant coach and then coaching at the college level and end up coaching in the WNBA. We talked a little about what you wanted in a coach, but what did you see, what did you witness from those people who coached through you through the years for a paradigm of leadership, who you wanted to be?
Well, I think it starts with work ethic. I think I've always believed in outworking people. And so when I both played and have coached under, preparation is a big thing to me. I think it shows you're willing to put in the work. And I think when people know you're willing to put in the work, it's a lot easier to demand that from your players. There's an expectation there, you know. And then I think the other big part of that is communication, and being able to communicate a game plan, an idea. And, you know, I always believe that, you know, the concept of truly fake it till you make it. I'm very much a process-oriented person. In fact, when I first took the job and got to know some of the local media and we'd lose a game, I'm pretty transparent how, you know, kind of disappointed I am when games are over and I would get these texts, "Coach, are you doing all right? You know, we're just checking on you," which was sweet, quite frankly. But I think people learn that we're all going to have a process, and my process is to be disappointed and then, you know, to strap my boots back up and figure out how we're going to win the next game. And by 10 a.m. the next morning, when I've got to be on the practice court with my team, that I'm that I'm smiling, that I'm, this is how we're going to get it done. And, you know, I know that if I believe it, it's easy to sell. So, you know, that's kind of my process. If I work hard enough and get to the point where I feel like I understand how we're going to beat an opponent, then it becomes really easy to help, you know, translate that message to a team.
That can be a really powerful thing when you discover how you behave as a person. And, you know, not everybody has that level of self-reflection. But how do you talk yourself through that, from that disappointment to that smile the next morning?
You know, I learned, certainly it's change going from an assistant to a head coach. All those years when you're in a supportive role, you're trying to make that head coach's job easier. And I was lucky enough to have a really good staff this year, but I'm also very hands-on. I had the most familiarity with this league because of my history in it. And so, you know, I was going to take a lot of that on still myself. So, you know, I just know that the harder I work, the more I'm going to get to that point, you know, where I understand what we need to do and how we need to do it. And then, you know, communicating that and truly believing and getting our team. I tried, you know, ironically, we didn't shoot the basketball very well. It's a short story, but to start the season, we were really good defensively. And I used to say after every game, hey, you guys, like, we're still hanging in there defensively, and we've got to hang our hat on that. But boy, when we start making shots, we're going to be fun to watch. And that would be my consistent message after games, win, lose, you know. And then we just had a couple games in a row where we continued to shoot it poorly. And so I came to practice one day and tried to put them in some competitive shooting drills and take a little bit of an approach of, hey, step up and make shots. You know, we've got, you know, and really changed, you know, how I tried to coach them. And it didn't work either. So we didn't shoot it well that game. I turned around the next practice. All right, I tried negative Nancy for a day. I am back to positive Patty, because it's really more of who I am. Over time, I've learned that's more who I am. You know, I've had to play both roles. I've been good cop. I've been bad cop as an assistant coach. But, you know, I'm going to lead from a place of being excited and pushing forward and how are we going to get this done.
Well, fun to watch is part of the narrative that I often hear when I read and hear about women's professional sports, especially the WNBA. People say, you know, great players, great gamesmanship, great thing to watch. So why then is there not the penetration? Why are there not the number of fans? Why aren't as many people watching? It's always defined as this kind of other. So how do you get people in the door? Do you think you can hook them once they are?
Absolutely. I think that's the hard part, is getting them through the door. And it always has been, because there's perception and there's, you know, what do people like about the men's game over the women's game? I think we don't, ironically, we don't, in certain sports where you have men's and women's sports, you have less point of comparison. You know, I mean, people talk all the time about, should we be lowering the rims in women's professional basketball? And it just doesn't make sense to me. We're not men's professional basketball. And you could lower the rims 6 inches or 8 inches, and we still wouldn't be dunking at the same level as the men are. So you've got to come to appreciate our game and how it's different. And I think it is different. I think our players need each other a little bit more. And so, you know, we're also in markets that are saturated with tons to do. And, you know, there was a time when you had to actually get in your car and drive to a game to watch them. And now so many of the games are on TV. And, you know, here we are in Atlanta, and we have so many professional sports and, you know, so many other things that people can do. So, you know, it is about getting them through the door and realizing that, you know, our players are the best athletes in the world. They're not the best athletes in the United States. They truly are the best athletes in the world. And they play hard and they play for each other. And they love what they do. They're certainly not doing it because, you know, their salaries are ridiculously high, but they have a true passion for the game and playing in front of friends and family and, you know, opportunity and being role models and all those things.
Well, I definitely want to get to salaries, but thinking of what you said about all the many things that there are to do in Atlanta, the utter embrace of Atlanta United that we've seen in just the last couple of years suggests the city is really willing to glom on to athleticism and sportsmanship beyond football here in the South. Does that spirit that's made this a soccer-loving town make it more open to women's basketball?
I certainly hope so. I went to 3 United games and was blown away, absolutely blown away. Not at the sheer number of fans, which in and of itself is an amazing thing, but kind of their spirit. I think they have a little bit of their own soccer culture, but it's very diverse. You know, and I think we need to appeal to some of those people, because I do think that, you know, the beauty of our game at a professional level is our players are truly touchable. And you can't say that about the NBA. The NBA is an incredible thing. The Hawks have given me a great opportunity to be at their training camp and to get to know them, and tons and tons of respect for the NBA. But we're just more touchable. You know, we don't have security guards hovering, you know, 24/7. We don't have those things. So, you know, our players are, you can feel them, you know, I think. And so we do have to reach families and young kids and show that we're role models. And, you know, our tickets are less expensive, you know, so, you know, we're excited about the idea of, can we get them back to State Farm? Because there are some people that can't afford a Hawks game at State Farm. But hey, check out State Farm Arena, because, mm-hmm. you know, once we get you in, and you, I don't care if you come because you want to see Top Golf in State Farm Arena, like, watch our players play, you'll want to come back.
And a beautifully newly renovated State Farm
Arena. It's
amazing. That it is. Well, I just want a little props for Atlanta women's sports. Lisa Borders, former WNBA president, a big reason that the Atlanta Dream actually exists. She was also president of the Atlanta City Council for a while. How did she make this a basketball town, as far as you're concerned?
Well, I think, you know, she helped get that group of people that were willing to invest in a dream, literally, here in Atlanta. I think when you think about, at least from a grassroots perspective, being in college as long as I was, Atlanta is a basketball town. I know the South is football driven. I've coached in the SEC. I enjoy SEC football. But if you took, you know, Texas and California and certain pockets of those states away, you would see that girls basketball in AAU is incredible. And events have always come here. Some of the bigger national events have always been in Atlanta. So this is a basketball city. And I think, you know, it put, you know, Atlanta on the map as a professional women's city. Drafting Angel McCautry as the number one pick, you know, was a big part of the start of that. But, you know, Lisa going on to be the WNBA president and now to be involved truly in, you know, kind of the Me Too movement and, you know, really looking out for women across the board, not just in athletics now, is pretty cool.
Yeah, she stepped away from the WNBA last year to become first CEO and president of Time's Up. So do you think that it's essential to have a little bit of the feminist and a little bit of the politician in you to be a leader in women's sports?
You know, I'll take that. I absolutely, you know, for me, it's, I've had so much opportunity that I can't help but in some ways be a spokesman in that area. And I coach women for a living, and I'm raising 2 daughters. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm willing to shoulder whatever it is to continue to get to coach the best athletes in the world, and at the same time have a voice, you know, that maybe is one that people will listen to.
And does that position, though, leading a woman's sport, does that ratchet up the pressure to be a mentor, to be looked at as a trailblazer?
I don't think I see that necessarily as pressure. I just think it's an added dimension of the game, and it's one that I fully embrace. I enjoy being in these situations. I enjoy meeting new people. I enjoy telling our story. I'm incredibly proud of what our players do and who they are and how they go about what they do. And our players have not been afraid to be controversial. More controversial than probably any other professional sport in terms of they're willing to stand up and be a part of Black Lives Matter and lean in and all kinds of other things that, you know, are going on in our country. Like, they've had no fear of that. And so, you know, I feel like it's my job to support them.
I'm speaking with the Atlanta Dream head coach, Nikki Collin. This is her second season with the team. Well, as a being a head coach, obviously a huge responsibility, but you were also, you mentioned, a mother of 3, including a set of twins, a wife. Is it possible to lean in and have it all for you? Or do you feel that tug that many parents, especially women, do feel about balancing the work and the work and the life?
I don't know that you can have it all, but you can certainly try. And I know that a really cool thing for me this year in being a head coach for the first time was I saw a different level of pride in my kids that I'm not sure I'd ever seen. Like, I know that they always love their mom. But as we were winning games and they were getting to be at press conferences afterwards and be in the locker room with our players and, you know, to even talk to their school counselor as we moved here to Atlanta and you know, them talk about how proud they are of me, that's a cool thing. And so, you know, as much as I love that I got to be home and be truly a stay-at-home mom for a few years when my twins were young, it also is exciting to show them that truly anything is possible. And, you know, it won't always be a straight path, but you can get to where you want to be.
Well, and the prestige and all of the trimmings, the press conferences and all, is a huge part of the appeal. But there are particular challenges for women's sports. The New York Times reports that the New York Times reports that the WNBA received just below 200,000 viewers on ESPN, we mentioned earlier. And then average pay. Several athletes have been vocal about inequality, about issues over the past few decades. Average pay now about $79,000 a year. Players who are lower on the totem pole might even have a hard time making ends meet. So for you, is it hard to get your players to practice hours and hours a day when paid comparatively less than, let's say, male athletes?
Whew. This is like one of those hot topics. Yeah. We're obviously in the middle of, you know, our players opted out of their collective bargaining agreement. It's probably a good thing because the dialogue then begins sooner rather than waiting to truly start that dialogue. I truly understand both sides of the equation here. I understand that our players you know, don't get paid a comparable salary to what people would think with the NBA at the same time. You know, we don't have a lot of franchises that turn a profit. And so, you know, you certainly have money coming in through TV deals with ESPN. But there's just not a bunch of money sitting around, you know, that's not being paid out. Our owners are not getting rich, you know, off of owning these professional teams. I will say that, you know, when you look at our league, you talk about the NBA and they have a soft cap at about $100 million, where we have a hard cap at about $1 million. So you look at, you know, we basically pay our players 1% of what an average NBA roster looks like. Now, there are so many factors in that. There are TV contracts. There are dollars, you know. I mean, when I think about how our league needs to grow, we need sponsorships. We need businesses who believe in what we do because that's where the money is. You know, it's not always in the marketing and recognition, although I think, you know, continuing to market our players at a high level is important. But I think it's getting businesses to believe in what we do and want to support it. And so, you know, there just are two sides of the coin. Now, do I think I have a hard time getting my players to practice hard? I think there are certain days that I do. And I'm sure there are certain days that $17 million men's players don't want to practice either. You know, I don't think the players get up on a daily basis and say, I'm not getting paid enough to do this. You know, I just, you know, our players, while I don't like that they have to do this or feel that they have to do this, you know, they go overseas and they make money over there. So, you know, most of them are making, you know, would probably, you know, if you think about the world in general or even the United States, they'd still be in the top probably 1%, you know, when you figure in what they make. Now, when you're a basketball player, you have a finite amount of time to make money. You know, you can't play basketball when you're 60. So, you know, they have to take advantage of the amount of time that they have to play.
We're getting a view inside the world and head, I think, of Nikki Collins. She is the Atlanta Dream head coach. We'll be back with more after a short break. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott, continuing a conversation, a rich conversation with Nikki Collins. She's a head coach of the Atlanta Dream. Well, Nikki, I want to pick up on what we were just talking about. If we can observe, there are many very talented men who've made it to the NBA, get a huge salary, and the inflation of ego and sense of invulnerability can swell along with that. Do you think that's a downfall of these mega salaries for even super talented players?
Well, I think you certainly, I think it's hard to not understand the power of money. You know, we've seen how, it doesn't matter if it's professional sports or it's wealthy people in general, them fall from grace because they got greedy. And I think that it's no different that, you know, any person needs to stay grounded in their principles and what got them to that point in order to be successful. I think that we can look at professional sports and a lot of these males that are making a lot of money and the percentage of them that are bankrupt by 45 because they don't know how to manage it and they don't know how to live with it. And that's in some ways a bigger concern to me than their egos, that they're making these huge salaries and they're spending it as if they're going to make it forever. And truly getting, you know, because you're talking about so often, you think about the NBA, most of these players are 19. Now they're playing 1 year of college basketball and then going pro at 19, and they've had handlers their whole life, kind of telling them what to do and telling them how good they are. And so it really isn't the real world. I mean, I can tell you being around that, you know, when you're used to personal chefs and you charter everywhere and, you know, what they do, they entertain. They entertain us, right? I mean, these guys they play sports, but they entertain us and they're amazing at their craft. And they certainly have all the resources at their disposal. So the question is, when you don't have the resources anymore, are you prepared for life after? That always to me is a bigger concern to me than, you know, do they get big egos? Because I think in some ways, part of their ego is what's part of what makes them good. Mm. You know, it keeps that edge. They think they're good. And our sport is very mental. Professional sports in general are mental. And you have to believe that you're the best when you step between the lines.
So that's a hard thing to coach, isn't it? You know, somebody who believes that they're the best. How do you negotiate that kind of, that's a psychological dynamic, a power dynamic in many ways.
It very much is. And I think it's getting, especially obviously in a team sport, getting each individual to believe that collectively, you know, that they're better. I think that, you know, if you want to be considered one of the greatest athletes, you don't want to be one of the greatest athletes that never won a championship, right? You know, I mean, how many times did we even talk about Phil Mickelson? You know, how many events he had won before he won his first major? Or, you know, you just have lots of those instances. So it's getting them to understand. It was so very easy when I came to town because they'd come off a disappointing year where they didn't meet expectations and they knew they were better. So I don't think it was hard for them to buy into giving a little to get a lot, you know, but I think that's part of it, is getting them to understand that they can still be individually successful and get individual accolades, but it's going to be better if the team's better.
For you, that must be sort of like a chess game. You figure out which pieces you have, what they can do. Do you enact a strategy from that? Do players work together for scripted plays or on the fly as the game unfolds?
It's both. We certainly have a system. And, you know, our goal when we took over was to truly get them to understand how to play from one action to the other so that it really was less scripted. Now, certainly, you know, as a coach, you are always going to define yourself a little bit by your, we call them ATOs, after timeout. So, you know, you come out of a timeout, you've diagrammed something very specific based on a matchup, something that you're seeing out on the court, and your ability to execute in that situation, I think, is just one of those things that coaches really, really look at, how you execute in late game situations. But you truly try to get them to play in a system where they trust one another, where they play to each other's strengths. And you build that, you know, going in. I knew the players that I inherited, and then combined with the players that we added in free agency, we kind of thought we knew where our strengths were and tried to build our system around our strengths.
We mentioned salary as one of the big challenges for the league. What are some of the other ones?
I think sometimes it's, you know, obviously last year we had some travel issues. You know, we're not a league that charters or is probably going to get anywhere near that. Mm-hmm. You know, when you look at the cost, it's you know, it's just hard to even
to move a team from place to place. Obviously.
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, sometimes it's the travel, it's the It's the shortness of the season. It's the fact that our players play year round because they'll, and so sometimes we have players that show up late to training camp or are late because they're not going to leave their Turkish team before the end of the season because they're making $500,000 with their Turkish team and 70 with us. So what, you know, where do we fall? You know, and as much as I think our players put great value on playing the WNBA because they know it's the most competitive league in the world, you know, it's almost like we're the second job sometimes. Hmm. And so I think pay goes into that, you know, that perception that that's how it is. And so that's a lot. Sometimes it's facilities, you know, it can be a big thing. You know, we play in the summer, so we don't have some of the overlap. When the league started, all the teams were owned by NBA teams, and so it was a way to use those arenas in the summer. Now, we only, 5 of our 12 teams are still owned by NBA teams, and the others are individually owned. So, you know, it's negotiating those contracts in facilities and practice facilities and things like that.
Getting better pay in Turkey or in Greece or other places, why do you think that is? What's your theory on why the game, the women's game, is venerated, supported, paid for differently? As you mentioned, the best players are here in the WNBA.
When you think about professional basketball overseas, they have a totally different system. So they don't have college systems. They have club systems. And so not unlike people in Georgia grow up and either their alma mater is Georgia, and so they continue to support the University of Georgia as their alma mater. But that's their team. Well, overseas, these teams these players play for, these clubs, that's how people are grow up. In Turkey, you grow up and you're a Fenerbahce, you know, person. You're, you know, and so it's about, there's money coming in and there's individual ownership that, you know, for tax reasons, for a lot of different reasons, pay Americans to come over. When you watch a game, it's not as if when you watch a game in Turkey, and I watch EuroLeague games every Wednesday, Euro Cup games Thursday, like I am watching these games overseas. They're not putting 12,000 people. These facilities don't even hold that. You know, they might not have more people than we have at our game, but they don't have the same cost for facilities, mm-hmm. you know? They don't have, and so to me, it's just more, if we could compare it, their system is almost aligns more like our college system, where you have money coming into these clubs and this built-in loyalty and camaraderie. And so it's different. It's just a totally different system.
Do you think that the NBA could be helping to do more to promote the WNBA?
This is one of those tough ones for me because the NBA actually does do a lot for our league. And you get so torn because on one hand, we have people saying, we're women, we can stand on our own, we don't need them. And then on the other hand, we have people saying, they have so much money, why don't they just throw a little our way? And to me, those things contradict one another, right? Like, we want to say we're as good, we should get paid the same, and then we want them to throw us a bone, you know? And so I think they do more than people realize. I would not turn down anything that they would want to share, you know, but I also think it contradicts some of who we're saying we're trying to be, you know, and saying that we need their help.
We're digging into the behind the scenes of the Atlanta Dream and the WNBA with Nikki Collins. She's the head coach. It's her second season at the team. And of course, part of the system here, part of what makes it work is the stars. Big part, stars, part of the formula, makes a professional sports team tick. They help win games. They help sell tickets. And I think little girls need a name to put on the back of those jerseys they wear for games. For years, the Dream and a lot of those jerseys referenced Angel McCautry. So what has her star power meant for the Dream?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, the absolute turnaround from their first year when they just had a part of the supplemental draft to, you know, when Angel came on board, the quick turnaround, you know, clearly she was a player that made a difference on the basketball court. I think she adopted Atlanta. She's from Baltimore. I actually helped recruit her to Louisville, and my husband was the head coach there when she was Big East Player of the Year. So there was already, for me coaching her, there was a background story coming in. But yeah, I mean, she is genuine. She loves to play basketball. She had star power because she was so athletic, but she also oftentimes played her best basketball in the biggest moments. Her playoff average is still the highest in WNBA history, even though the Dream, you know, were swept into WNBA finals, getting to the finals, being Eastern Conference champions. So, you know, I think she turned this place around in terms of success, and still would like to see, you know, to be able to hold a trophy up ultimately.
And she took a year off. She did get injured. Who's filling her sneakers, if I can say that now?
You know, that's still to be determined. You know, we had an all-rookie performer the year that Angel didn't play. I was not here, but Brittany Sykes made the all-rookie team and was runner-up for Rookie of the Year. And then naturally kind of fell into a backup role with Angel returning to the Dream here in my first season. I think when Angel went down in August, we continued to win. And, you know, Brittany Sykes was able to kind of fill her role to some degree, you know. But I don't think that, you know, when we got into the playoffs and needed a big play, you know, having an Angel McCautry mattered.
We talked about Lisa Borders having taken over the helm at Time's Up. We are living in the post-Me Too and Time's Up movement time. And the voice for women, the ignored voices, are being heard in a different way. There are many high-profile athletes who have spoken out about this. I'm thinking of tennis star Serena Williams, called out sexism and racism in professional tennis. You mentioned that people on your team, behind the Black Lives Matter movement, no compunction about that. But do you think the voice against sexism is as strong?
It's funny because I think about, you know, my kids. My kids are 13, 13, and 11. And I don't think my girls think there is a thing that they can't do in this world, you know? And they just, they have no blinders on, or maybe they have total blinders on when it comes to homosexuality or so many of these issues that, you know, for an older generation were issues. Like, you know, when I look at my 13-year-old and my 11-year-old, they just don't see the world that way. They wonder if you have a boyfriend or a girlfriend, and there's just no judgment, right? Like, it's really cool. And so I think that so much of this sexism stems from a place that is truly the minority and not the majority anymore. But with social media, with the world we live in, they can make their voices loud, you know, because there's a platform for everyone to be an expert on anything. And maybe sometimes we listen too much. But, you know, I think that's at the root of some of this, you know, this whole, you know, I could beat you in a one-on-one game. You know, our players, we don't pretend to think that we could take our best player in the WNBA and that they would be an NBA All-Star. Like, our players are smart enough to know that that's not who they are. Like, we as females were not created equal to men. We were created differently and wonderfully, and, you know, but and we're incredibly athletic, and our players are incredibly athletic, but they're not NBA players. They're not 5'11 versions of the 6'7 NBA player. And so, you know, so much of the pushback and the sexism from our side is from people who just are never going to appreciate what we do.
Would it be a dream of yours that you never get asked questions like that again? You know, that it doesn't become, this is a woman's game compared to the men's game. You know, that it isn't always the otherizing, I guess.
Absolutely. I think when there isn't a reference point that you like us because you, I mean, for some reason in tennis, Serena Williams' serve, you know, speed is not compared to Nadal's. Like, it just, now, what do they think? This woman is incredibly powerful, and wow. I mean, but, you know, it's not compared as much. So, you know, absolutely, I'd love to think that our league, our game, could stand on its own, because I think it's an incredible game, you know? I mean, if you love basketball, I think you'd love the WNBA.
I know it's a business. You got to make money. You got to pay people. You got to take care of them. But your dream, for the Dream, on the court and in the stands and in the community.
Oh, so many things. Part of moving here, most WNBA coaches don't actually live where they work. And so moving to market has really brought me closer to the core of what you're talking about. It's who is the Dream? Who do we want to be? You know, I want to be connected in this community. I absolutely love what I do. I know that ultimately, if we're successful, that I can probably get a higher paying job in college, but I love coaching pros. And so for me, the dream, I mean, we want to bring a championship to Atlanta. There's no doubt that is both a franchise goal and, quite frankly, a personal goal to be able to, you know, hold a championship trophy up and have a parade and, you know, all those things. So I think on the basketball side, it's that. But I also think that, you know, when I took this job, one of the things I told our fans is that win or lose, I want them to be proud of our effort and I want them to be proud of how we act when we play. And so continue to understand that, you know, we're going to be good citizens and we're going to be role models and we're going to care about this community. And so, you know, I want to matter in Atlanta. I say there's 6 million people. And, you know, when we were at Georgia Tech and there were 8,000 people, it's like, surely there's 8,000 people in this 6 million, you know, people city that can care about women's basketball on any given night. And so, you know, I want to see people support this team because I think these players deserve it.
Nikki Collin, really, really enjoyed talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
That's the Atlanta Dream head coach, Nikki Collin, sharing her reflections and looking forward as the team leader. And that is our show for today. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, and the Raven Taylor. Tyler Morris is our engineer, and Don Smith, the Dean of Grammar. Amy Kiley is our senior producer. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter at OST Talk. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for spending some time with us. This is On Second Thought.